Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Music podcast. In this episode, I speak with Andre Sirois, author of Hip-Hop DJs and the Evolution of Technology, Cultural Exchange, Innovation, and Democratization. Our conversation explores the history of DJs in hip-hop and their role in shaping the sound and technology that allowed hip-hop to flourish. We also discuss how DJs get credited, compensated, and gain a legacy for their technological and musical innovations.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Well, let's start by exploring how this book came about. How did you decide to write a book about DJs as technological innovators?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question. I actually didn't decide that necessarily. It kind of came to me through the research. So, you know, when some people do ethnography, broadly defined, they kind of, you know, see what comes out of the questions they ask and the people they interact with. And so for me, coming into this project, which was, you know, my dissertation, I initially had pitched as really being interested in how like digital DJ vinyl technology was kind of changing the culture and music business and how DJs were sort of negotiating it. And that ultimately became part of this book. And so bearing that in mind, that's kind of where I was going with it. So my first interview for this project, I connected with Mike May, who at the time was at this company called Rain. And I write about them in the book. And Rain is a company that's local to me in that they are in outside of Seattle, so about 6-hour drive for me. And I wanted to connect with him because Rain manufactured the hardware for the industry standard digital vinyl system, which is Serato Scratch Live at the time. So literally my first interview for this project, I got on my motorcycle, I took a 6-hour trip up to Seattle, and I go to Rain headquarters. And I met with Mike, I spent the whole day there, I toured the facility, it was super cool. And you know, when I sat down and started interviewing him, you know, we started talking kind of about how all the relationship happened with between Rain and Serato and a little bit about the company's history. And he told me, we kind of got talking. He told me the story about this mixer called the Rain 52 or the Rain 54, excuse me, and which was like their first mixer aimed at, you know, hip hop DJs. It was a battle style mixer or whatever. And he told me the whole story about like how like Rain, who had been making mixers and audio equipment for a while, were approached at a trade show by 4 like hip hop DJs and how they said, you know, your products are great. You make great products, but they don't work for this growing market, which is scratching and turntablism and hip hop DJs, you know, and they had some ideas and they brought some ideas to them and ultimately became, you know, the Rain 54 mixer. And I was like sitting there and listening to him. And I'd heard these stories through the grapevine. And I knew like DJs had been involved and, you know, had been credited in some ways as inventors or innovators or designers. But, it was just so cool to hear that story and to hear like this company, you know, guy at a company, national sales manager or whatever, tell me about it. And then we go out into the lobby and there's like a little mini plaque dedicated to those 4 DJs and what they did. But I was just like, my mind was kind of blown and I was like, wow, I'm like, you know, driving home on my motorcycle, just thinking the whole time about the project. And basically it kind of went from there. And then I just started talking to more and more people and, kind of asking those types of questions along with the whole digital, you know, digitization part. So it kind of really came from the research itself right from the jump, and it kind of came to me. And I, you know, was really thankful that I was, you know, that I was given that story, but also given, I don't know, the creative ability to kind of deviate from my initial concept and do something that I think was a little bit more meaningful than just like, let's look at, you know, the negotiation of digital technology. So that sort of led me down like a pretty long path, over the next 6-7 years with all this project.
So you are a DJ, and how do you think being a DJ shaped the kinds of questions you asked, shaped how other DJs responded to you, and maybe even responded how the industry responded to you.
Yeah, I mean, being a DJ, so I mean, to kind of put this in context, like I, you know, have been a hip hop head since I was a little kid, caught the breakdance bug in the 80s, and, you know, been DJing since the late 90s. So I really was kind of into DJing and the music side far before I had any interest in academia. And so it took me actually a while as I moved through grad school. You know, I wrote a thesis on sampling and music and the legality of it, and I got into a PhD program, and it kind of took me through my first year to actually think that DJing, specifically hip hop DJing and scratching in any sort of way, would be of any academic value. So it took, you know, some really cool professors that I had, a folklorist and some people in the subcultural studies and, like, you know, media, new media at the time, or, you know, theory, to kind of like open my mind to that. But with that said, once I kind of got there and I started asking questions, and, you know, a lot of how I framed my questions and what I asked, I mean, this is stuff that I would talk about on the regular with my homies, with the DJs, you know, like, it was just like, these were like things we talked about, like, just like, yo, like, initially, like, what's this like corny ass digital shit? Like, what are these CDJs? Like, what, you know, just like, what is digital vinyl final scratch? This is some bullshit, you know? And just like, you know, like, you know, talking about authenticity, you know, and non sort of academic terms. So, I mean, these were all these conversations that I had with DJs in this project were stemmed from really conversations that I just had in everyday sort of life. So, I mean, I really kind of like, it was just really weird. I was kind of like a participant observer, but more of a participant because I was always observing, you know? And so, you know, but I mean, totally. I mean, when I look back at my questions and I look back at everything, I mean, it's very clear that, you know, I was a DJ. I mean, you look at the book, it's very, I don't know if you'd say like sympathetic towards DJs, but I'm really trying to shine light on the DJs in a different way. So just how I asked the questions, the ways that I asked the questions, who I asked, a lot of that, you know, was based on my history and knowledge that had nothing to do with academics. And so, you know, that's the blessing and the curse, I think, of this project. You know, when you have, you know, people doing ethnographies and people writing about cultures and subcultures, you know, there's a certain strand of thought in academia that really privileges, you know, objectivity or you know, kind of like an outsider perspective. But, you know, and being able to sort of navigate that without not having a lot of investment in the culture topic. But then there's other people who think there's great value to having that. Like, a lot of the communication I had and people I connected with were people I just had relationships with before I was pursuing this in academic sort of fashion. So, I mean, when you talk about snowball sampling, I mean, it was really like, you know, I think having that DJ edge and being able to approach people and be like, yo, what's up? My name is Andre, DJ Food Stamp. You know, I'm interested in this. I'm writing, you know, dissertation on this. Would you want to talk about it? I mean, just, you know, I think for a lot of people, when they get like an interview request and it's very formal and sort of academic and, you know, whatever, I think maybe there's a little resistance to that. So I think it definitely helped get me in the door with the DJs. I think on the industry side, I think too, like, you know, like, I mean, for me, I had to talk to people in the industry because I wanted to give kind of a little bit of light to both sides and give their perspective. I think that's like the journalist background in me and that whole thing. But, you know, I think like definitely the questions I asked people in manufacturing and the industry side were, you know, I mean, those were totally, you know, tinted by my sort of background as a DJ. And just, you know, I've always kind of felt like for a long time, the DJ's kind of been like, specifically in hip hop, you know, most hip hop DJs have kind of a chip on their shoulder in the sense of like, you know, hip hop culture kind of stemmed from DJing. And then once it became rap, you know, the hip hop DJ got kind of brushed aside, and then they like, you know, made their own sort of thing out of it. And so I think, you know, with that in mind too, like a lot of people wanted to talk, like they wanted to tell their stories and give their perspectives and, you know, have all these people who contributed to technologies who never really got any props for it, who really wanted to kind of talk about that stuff and find a place where they could get some props for a contribution they made that wasn't like, oh, I, you know, popularized this scratch technique or whatever, you know, how could we shine light on DJs in a different way? So that's really kind of at the end of the day for me, what it was about was just kind of giving some shine to DJs in a different way and kind of framing them in a different way. And it's clearly biased in a lot of ways, you know, and some people may think that's great. And some people, you know, may destroy my writing and perspective for that, you know, and find it problematic.
Well, that's why I was so excited about your book, because I just think the DJs are just such an underexplored element of hip hop. And so when I saw your title, I was like, finally, you know, some more work, real work on DJs. So I was thrilled about that. And so maybe can we segue a little bit about like the role of the DJ, especially in the history of hip hop? You kind of mentioned it a little bit a few minutes ago. But like, you know, what was the role of the DJ sort of in the early days? And what are some of the misconceptions people have about the role of the DJ?
I mean, there's this sort of, you know, narrative, and you have to understand, you know, I think, you know, we're talking about the early 70s. We're talking about, you know, groups of, you know, young, you know, African American and, you know, Puerto Rican, you know, teenagers, I mean, kids essentially, right? In the South Bronx, and the sort of, you know, forgotten about or you know, forgotten about intentionally by a lot of institutions, you know, and you know, and there was no documentation, right? Like, you know, it's the early 70s. So it's not like now where, you know, something comes out and it's like, it spreads like wildfire, you know, I mean, it's, you know, there's even like, you know, a webpage you can go and find like, know your meme, right? You can find like the source of your meme or whatever, you know? So there's always a way to kind of like document history now, like so much where people are documenting the fact that they ate a burrito. Well, you know, none of this obviously existed in the 70s with this community. And so, you know, the history of the DJ, you know, in the 70s is kind of, it's kind of come down to this sort of grand narrative, and that, you know, the pioneers of hip hop have kind of, and the people who are disciples to that have kind of collectively told and retold, and it's been told in, you know, Hollywood films and Netflix films and all this stuff. And that's kind of, you know, the story is, you know, it sort of centers on, you know, one specific DJ, which is DJ Kool Herc, who's given credit. And I think the important thing to note is like, you know, in hip hop culture and DJ culture too, specifically, you know, it's kind of about like what people agree on, who did what, and if it's published and if it's fixed in a medium of some sort, right? And so, you know, basically the narrative really focuses on, you know, young Clive Campbell, DJ Kool Herc, who basically started giving parties in the early 70s at, you know, the rec center at his, you know, apartment complex. And, you know, Herc was, you know, given credit for like, you know, finding like really records that weren't being played on the air, you know, that weren't popular. They weren't like, you know, disco type hits or, you know, hit music. And he was finding like these really raw and edgy, you know, James Brown records and, you know, an incredible bongo band. And, you know, he's finding these records that were, you know, had songs, and the songs were very percussive, and they would, you know, have a percussive breakdown, you know, drum break, but mainly, you know, really percussive sort of breakdowns, not like a raw drum break like a sample DJ would use or producer would use, but I'm talking like, you know, with some conga sounds or bongos or whatever, you know. And he found, like, you know, when that part of the song would hit, that his dancers, the people at his party, you know, they kind of go bonkers and they'd lose their minds. So he figured out, he's like, shit, he's like, why play the whack part, you know, the part where people are just kind of dancing around? I'm going to just play, you know, the rhythmic percussive break sections. And so he would kind of just play those sections and you play them over and over again of the same record, and you go back and forth between different sections, and, you know, kind of the B-boy dance and B-girl dance kind of developed from that and from him. And that's sort of like the real bare bones, like, narrative story of hip hop DJing. And from, you know, eventually he brought on his homie Coke LaRock, who would get on the microphone and, you know, welcome people to the party, you know, shout out announcements, because Herc was like so busy trying to like play breaks and go through his records and all that stuff. And, you know, Coke LaRock became sort of known as the first MC, you know. And then you have, you know, then the other part of the trilogy of the grand narrative story focuses on Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash. You know, and the part about Bambaataa people always talk about is, you know, he helped start the Zulu Nation and he was a former gang member, and, you know, in his neighborhood of the South Bronx started, this organization, and they were about positivity and, you know, things like that. And he was really known as like the master of records. So he's really digging for rare, different types of stuff, not funk and soul, but rock and, you know, kraut rock and, you know, all sorts of shit, and breaking that to his crowd. Then you have Grandmaster Flash, who, you know, kind of, if you watch The Get Down on Netflix, you know, you get this really kind of crazy version of Grandmaster Flash, you know, as this, like, you know, sensei sort of character. But, you know, all that aside, you know, Flash basically, you know, he did a lot of things, and I think, you know, he's really, for me, he's like a real central figure in this book. And God damn it, I wish I could get in touch with him and interview him. And I've had, you know, some back and forth with him and trying to make it happen. Because really, he kind of, you know, out of everybody, kind of set the tone for the DJ as innovator, like naming, really focusing on naming his techniques and, you know, and really presenting them with a name. And his main thing was his, you know, quick mix theory. And what he did is, you know, he figured out, you've seen The Get Down, he uses a crayon, but he figured out like how to take two copies of the same record with a drum break on them. And he figured out how to use, you know, markings on the record to let the drum break play on turntable two, and then the same drum break on turntable one. When the break would end on turntable two, he'd cross over to turntable one, and on time he would drop, you know, the break, the same break on turntable one. He'd backspin on turntable two to his marker, and then when the break would end on turntable one, he'd drop it back on turntable two. It created basically an infinite loop on time. And, you know, he learned by watching, you know, they all went to Cool Herc's parties and learned from watching Herc, and, you know, Flash was like, oh man, he's playing these breaks, he's playing these old records, but he's sloppy as hell. You know, he's like not on time. And so Flash wanted to be really scientific about it. And, you know, according to all accounts in his biography and, you know, everything. And so Flash was really the one to kind of figure out how to loop a drum break. And, you know, with the Furious Five, his MCs, you know, specifically Melly Mel, they really started to advance the MCing part because they had a solid loop created by Flash, you know. And then the other person in the narrative is Grand Wizard Theodore, who, you know, another South Bronx DJ. He was real young. I mean, we're talking about like these dudes are, you know, 13, 14, 12, 15, 16, right? All they're doing really is just trying to do something to feel some value and to do something as kids, you know, and they're into it and they're into the fame and they're into, like, you know, getting chicks and, like, you know, making a little money or whatever, you know, not really thinking like this is going to be like a multi-billion dollar industry. You know, they're not really thinking about it like that. And so, like, that's again why a lot of, like, this didn't get archived or, you know, a lot of journalism on it until later. But Grand Wizard Theodore is often given credit as, you know, being a pioneer. I don't like to say inventor per se, but, you know, he was one of the innovators and popularized scratching. So he would kind of took what Flash did, and Flash was like one of a mentor of him, and he figured out what took Flash's rub, where Flash would like rub the record back and forth, and what Theodore did is he figured out he could take like a horn stab or something and he could cut it over another record and he could do it rhythmically and do it musically, etc., etc. And that's kind of like the grand narrative, is like the DJs were like the sort of king of like early hip hop culture, because like they had the records, they had the sound system, they had the ability to loop the records. So the MCs, the rap, AKA, you know, eventually becoming rappers, relied on, like, everybody relied on them. If the DJ didn't show up, the B-boys and B-girls couldn't dance, you know? So, I mean, like, they were the central force, the star, right? And then in 1979 or whatever, when, Rapper's Delight came out and Sylvia Robinson famously went and found, some dudes who wanted to make a record that would replicate what was happening in the South Bronx for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years in the parks, and figured, you know, we could isolate this and sell this on a record and people could listen to it at home. That really kind of changed everything. And that's like really the moment, because Rapper's Delight, what she did is Sylvia Robinson, who had experience in the music industry, funk and soul. She had a bunch of hits. Anyways, she found three guys who would rap, who could kind of rap. And this is a very, famous story. And, she brought them into a studio and she had basically session musicians replicate what DJs were doing, which was taking a rhythmic part of a song or a funky part of a song and looping it. Well, they would just basically play a loop of, like, you know, a popular kind of like disco hit. So that was Good Times by Chic, which would come out a few months earlier. And once that happened and Rapper's Delight came out, you know, you had all, and started making all this money and whatever, you had all these DJ crews and MC crews who were like, holy shit, like, there's a lot of money to be made off of this. We didn't think anybody would buy it. And so they all started making records and all started getting jerked. I mean, fucked over, totally screwed by these record labels, often like independent black owned record labels, but by people who had some industry savvy, would kind of get over on these kids. And when that started happening, you know, once rap records started coming out as disco rap, the format was the same, right? You didn't need a DJ to cut up the instrumental backing. It was all done by session musicians. And session musicians were trying to replicate what DJs were doing. And that's what they did. And it displaced the DJ. You don't need a DJ if you have session musicians. And eventually the session musicians got replaced by digital sampling technology, and the DJ kind of, what was their role? They went from being like the king of their neighborhood and like a god, you know, and being super important to, you know, nothing. Literally almost overnight, like Grandmaster Flash went from being like one of the most important and popular DJs for the most important and popular crew at the time, to like, he was so frustrated because they'd go into the studio and did all these records on Sugar Hill Records with called Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And he did nothing on those records. He did not one thing. He didn't do a scratch. He didn't do anything. So we go into the studios and he was pissed So eventually they let him put out Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, which he basically, to me, I call it the first hip hop record, because it was a DJ cutting up other records, which is, to me, is like the foundation of hip hop is a DJ manipulating, you know, records. And so that was like, to me, like the first hip hop record. Everything else was rap records, right? It was just ultimately different because there's no DJ involved. And so from that, I think DJs kind of went back underground in a way, and they started doing their own thing and coming up with, they obviously toured and backed rappers and did all that stuff, but they started creating their own thing and, you know, engaging in like the new music seminar battles and the DMC battles and really kind of like just advancing technique on their own in their bedrooms and their studios, because, you know, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for them, and they felt like they sort of were cast aside. And so that's why I think in hip hop DJ culture, there is sort of a chip on a lot of their shoulders. And, I don't think a lot of people really get that, because now you have, like DJs were like, even in like club cultures and stuff, England and like, Europe and stuff, DJs were kind of like bottom feeders, like specifically club and party DJs. They were kind of like, they weren't paid a lot of money, they weren't really, valued in a lot of ways. And then what you have now is like people getting multi-million dollar contracts to play in Vegas, and DJs making $30, $40 million a year. So a lot of people see it as a very glamorous thing, and like they don't really understand like the sweat and work and sort of like the bullshit to get to that point. And frankly, a lot of the people who paved that road are not getting compensated, are not living a good life. I mean, just a few years ago, DJ Kool Herc, the dude credited for, more or less inventing hip hop, in the sense of isolating the drum break, like being like, yo, this is the break, and bringing out the dance and like bringing in the emceeing and all that stuff. The dude, I think he had to have some like, he had some gallbladder or gallstone shit. I mean, he was working at FedEx, and they had to do like a GoFundMe type thing that his sister did, ironically, because this, his first party jam that he gave was to raise money so she could buy new school clothes. You know what I'm saying? Ironically, like 30, 40 years later, she's doing like an online funding thing so like he can get medical attention. You know what I'm saying? That's And then you have all these cats who are, they've come from that, him as the sort of, the seed, and they're making, millions and millions of dollars, not in just DJing, but rapping and just off of kind of like his seed, and here's this guy, who gets a lot of credit and a lot of props, from the culture, from the people that have any investment in the culture. But your average, 20-year-old who likes rap music and trap music and stuff, they don't know who Kool Herc is, But I mean, like, there's no royalties for him. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, so I think a lot of people don't kind of like take that into consideration in a lot of ways when they're enjoying sort of the long genesis of his fruits or labor, I guess.
One of the themes that you talk about in your book, and I think this is kind of the right place to maybe get at it, is how there's a lot of collaboration among hip hop DJs and how that doesn't quite fit with how credit and ownership kind of works in the industry. So can you maybe talk a little bit about what you found about the culture?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look back and you can't, I kind of romanticize it in a lot of ways, and that's based upon my observations, and I think, like, you know, DJing is very open source. It really exemplifies to me open source. I mean, if you think about a DJ in the 70s throwing a jam at a park, you know, and showing off their skills, that's like the internet of 1974 to me, you know. But there were like always proprietary things going on. Like all like the early DJs would put, they would, you know, obscure the labels of their records because their monopoly in their neighborhood was based on the fact that they knew the ill breaks and the ill records, you know. And so there were sort of proprietary, you know, things like that. But in general, you know, people, DJs specifically, have always kind of like shown one another things. Like they've shown one another techniques, and like they've shared pretty openly techniques, and people, and whether it's directly, like they're like, yo, check this out, which, you know, is how I learned, is from people who are better than me, like showing me how to do certain things. And I've done the same thing, you know. That's it's a pretty open source in that capacity. And then sort of indirect things where like DJs would partake in a DJ battle in the 80s, and that would get distributed on VHS tape, or in the 90s. And then like people would buy those and they would see what they were doing. And so like the ideas were kind of sharing and going viral in a very 80s and early 90s sort of way. You know, and so I think that in general, like how technique, DJ technique develops is a sort of very open source sort of way, the sort of network, right? Very collaborative, even if it's indirectly, but it can be super direct. And within that network, you know, you have to look at, you know, open source and stuff like that. It's as much as it is like a practice, or Creative Commons is a, you know, a licensing system, it's also an ideology. Just like, you know, the idea of like singular authorship and all rights reserved, copyright and stuff is also an ideology. And that's the mainstream ideology that we live in. So, I mean, I think a lot that is part of the reason why a lot of DJs emphasize credit and credit for their innovations and, you know, sort of more proprietary, you know, behaviors. But I think that also relates to like legacies and brands and like things like that, right? Like if you pioneered and popularized a style, you want to get credit for it because it's your legacy, it's your ego, or whatever. But I think, you know, collaboration showing, I mean, you know, you can Google any scratch technique and people share how to do it. DJs were putting out how-to videos in like the late 90s with like tech manufacturers. Granted, you know, that's a for-profit thing, but they were putting out their techniques. They were like showing people how to do things. So I think, you know, that's always been a major part of the culture and how the culture advances. I mean, if people could just patent or own a DJ technique, I mean, it'd be really hard to innovate. I mean, you know, if you took like what happens in the software industry, right, where you patent an idea and then like anybody wants to do something and they pretty much design a software knowing they're going to get sued. I mean, imagine if DJ technique could be like the same sort of way, you know, you would never advance. So I do think that, you know, there is an element of proprietariness when it comes to legacies and credit for innovation. But I also think like what supersedes that, I mean, I think credit is very important, but I think actually advancement of the culture and the technique is like paramount to like anything. I think that kind of from my research and what I found from people and people who collaborated with technology companies, where it's like, yeah, you know, it'd be dope, really dope to get money. It'd be cool to get some credit, but like honestly, like we wanted to advance the technique and the culture. And so we'll share our ideas for products to advance the culture. And I think that's super like open source mentality and collaborative mentality. And I think it's sort of, you know, at the heart of the culture itself. I don't think people, a lot of DJs think about it like that or recognize it like that, because it's also very competitive for money, for props, you know, all that stuff. But I do think it's one of the main driving forces that often goes unrecognized in DJ culture. And I think there's a ton of people who are advancing DJ technique for the sole purpose of just like being able to do it and to like be dope and like showcase like styles and get props for their styles, and to also like have other people take, you know, kind of their ideas and their innovations and do something new with it. And that's the whole thing, you know, in hip hop, it's like, don't bite, you know, don't copy. But if you're going to copy, you know, copy to advance, like copy to do something better with it. And that's totally like dope, you know, like to figure out like, oh, like I'm going to take this skill set or these technique, these combinations of techniques, and I'm going to flip it in my own way with my own style and like do something new with it is not a frowned upon activity. But like just copying somebody is, you know, totally frowned upon. So I think, again, people share and copy and imitate, but advance through that imitation is a major part of how things move forward and how styles move forward.
Well, one of the interesting things that you describe a few times in the book is when you had some innovative DJs had kind of an innovative technique, and it would sort of, they would either bring it to a technology company or the technology company would learn about it, and then they would kind of build a device that did what they were looking for. So the DJs went from being kind of like innovators to then consumers. Can you maybe talk maybe about the hamster or maybe another example of how that worked out?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of the crazy thing is like, you know, if you look at what was going on in New York City in the 70s, is you have DJs that were doing like crazy technological things, because, you know, while DJ mixers existed in like some high-end clubs or whatever, you know, the average dude, you know, in those urban areas didn't have access to a custom-built sound system or mixer. So they were doing crazy things like taking two receivers for a stereo, and one stereo receiver would control one turntable and the other would control the other turntable, and they would just crossfade the volume levels, or they would like figured out ways to like basically take two turntables and plug one into the left channel and one into the right channel. And how they crossfade between signals is they would use the pan control on like a stereo receiver to go from turntable one to turntable two. So they're doing all this crazy stuff in like the parks, right? And there's a real interesting documentary that came out that I mentioned in the conclusion or epilogue of the book. It's called Founding Fathers, and it sort of contests the grand narrative I talked about earlier with Kool Herc and the South Bronx, and it's all these sort of like disco style DJs who are doing like the same thing but a couple years earlier in parks, but less of like the breakbeat stuff and the b-boy stuff and the MCing stuff. And there's a part in the film where this DJ DJ Vernon, who's part of this crew, where he talks about this guy Ricky Grant, who figured out how to hijack, and he was doing all these crazy, like, you know, creating like engineering essentially sound systems, but he figured out how to like hijack an old mixer so like he could actually mix between two signals. And Vernon says, you know, and then some slick ass engineer from GLI saw that, and they came out with the GLI 3800, which was like one of the first like, you know, mixers that was made to not be installed in a club. And so that's kind of like the story of at least my vision, you know, and version of, what happens in the relationship between, you know, DJ culture, hip hop DJ culture specifically, and manufacturing companies is not necessarily like they steal the idea, but, they sort of see what DJs are doing and sharing, and then they incorporate that into technology. And so, you know, after that, you know, nobody was really, they were all making mixers in the 70s for like disco type DJs and, you know, for like, you know, mobile DJs and like parks and stuff. And so all these hip hop DJs were using these, you know, we're talking about the Clubman mixers or the GLI mixers or Gemini mixers. And all these companies were based around New York City or the tri-state area. So they, you know, they were literally, and these weren't DJ, they weren't run by DJs. They didn't have DJs who worked there. They were engineers, you know, that made hi-fi equipment or stereo equipment or broadcast equipment, who basically took their existing technologies, microphone mixers and stuff, and they saw how DJs were doing things and they made their products to sort of accommodate them. You know, and like the first DJ mixer that ever was made was, I believe, in 1971 for DJ Francis Grasso. He's like a major disco DJ. And it was called Rosie, and it was designed by Alex Rosner. And the whole mixer is like this little box, and it just had a headphone cue on it so he could hear like what he was doing in the headphones, and it had some sliders so he could mix the signals. And that was designed based upon how Francis Grasso played records. So it was based, the design was based on his technique, right? And his innovations in technique, because he was an innovator in real early DJ culture. So, I mean, after you move past that, we get into the 80s, you know, you have all these mixers that are kind of, you know, being made, and they're not really accommodating like scratch DJs, hip hop DJs. They were aimed at like mobile DJs, club type DJs, all this stuff. And, you know, eventually what started happening in the early 90s is sort of a twofold thing that I sort of look at how like the mixers and a lot of products advance, technologically advance, or technical innovation is what I call it. It's referring to buttons and knobs and faders and stuff. Is that, number one, manufacturers started asking and collaborating with DJs on design. And we're talking about DJs who'd win DJ battles in like the early 90s. They would start collaborating with them on design. And or they would see what DJs would do with these designs, right? The techniques that would, you know, that would be allowed for through these new designs, and how DJs would manipulate and sort of subvert and customize and modify, et cetera, and do these new techniques. They would then sort of encode those ideas into new mixers and then sell them back to the culture at large, you know, in a way. So in this sort of cycle, you know, you have DJs who are well-known, who are sharing ideas, who are very advanced in their skills, we're sharing ideas and collaborating in research and development with technology manufacturers, you know, and then you have broadly like what do DJs do with these products once they're out there? Oh, they're doing these sort of things this sort of way. I never thought of like a hamster, like people are actually plugging in, you know, their turntables backwards and scratching that way. And so after like people were doing that, you know, in the Bay Area, you know, and I talk about the hamster style and the hamster switch, people started putting a switch on their mixers that would basically reverse which turntable would play when you had the crossfader on a certain side. So they were accommodating the technique, and all these things come out and then the culture does something new with them, and then it gets encoded into the technology. So, I mean, but at the end of the day, you know, the DJs are sharing ideas because they want to advance the product because they have these hopes and dreams for technique, right? Like things they want to do, sounds they want to make, ways they want to make sound that with all the modification in the world, they can't make it happen. So they share these ideas, design ideas and ideas with companies who have the means, who have the, you know, the engineering departments, who have the access to manufacturing and distribution. And DJs share those ideas because they want the ill products so they can make their hopes and dreams and that they have for sound and sound manipulation come alive. And that's, again, that gets back to this sort of open sourcedness and non-proprietary, sort of drive in the culture. The people who are actually collaborating with manufacturers, that's a small portion of the DJ culture, you know, and the rest of us are just buying that shit, you know, we're just buying it, you know, and the other way that they encode DJs, ideas into mixers is they make signature mixers. So like one of the first collaborations ever between a DJ manufacturing company and a DJ is DJ Trix, who's sort of an unknown DJ to a lot of us in the UK who won a DJ battle in the late 80s, and he approached Vestex, a Japanese manufacturing company, because he used their mixers and about like a little endorsement deal. And he's like, hey, I have this design for a mixer. And he drew it up and he put his signature on it and they put it out. And he was like, holy shit. Like, you know, and so with that, you know, then we're talking 91 or so, we have a really important moment where a DJ gives design ideas to a manufacturer and then they use him as an intellectual property to brand it, right? A signature mixer with his name on it, his picture on the box to try to sell it, to authenticate the product in the marketplace to, you know, dorks like me, you know, like just consumers, you know. And that was a major thing, and that became a major thing for Vestex, and it was a major innovation, was listening to DJs and then using superstar DJs on the box or out there basically as marketing faces for the product to authenticate it with all the people who were buying it, because, you know, it was one of the major ways of giving something that's just a bunch of buttons and sliders and knobs, authenticating it to the marketplace, giving it more value, was ascribing someone who had credibility in the marketplace and the culture, ascribing their name and their sort of brand value to something, making it authentic, and pushing it to consumers.
So how was someone like this DJ compensated being branded in this way and for giving his ideas?
Yeah. If we're talking about DJ Trix, I think for him, he was a teenager, you know, and he'd won a champion DJ championship battle, and he's a kid, and so like he was like, wow, I'm surprised they did it, to be honest. He was like, holy shit. And I, interestingly, for a long time before Vestex went bankrupt a couple years ago, he was like one of the heads of Vestex Europe. I mean, he eventually became like, you know, a corporate dude there, which is, you know, kind of interesting in itself. But compensation is a very interesting part. You have a lot of people that I talk to who contributed ideas, who outright designed mixers, who never got any credit at all. For instance, the guys I talked about where my whole like genesis with this started with Rain, you know, these are kind of dudes that you may know if you're a DJ, but a lot of people don't. DJ Big Wiz, Mars One, Peter Parker, Sugar Cuts, you know, who approached Rain and were like, you should make this. You know, Rain wasn't going to put them on the box or on the front of, you know, give them a signature mixer because no one really knew who they were. You know what I'm saying? So like they gave their ideas because they wanted to make a dope product, but they also didn't get credit, you know, in any sort of meaningful way other than a little plaque in the in the headquarters, you know. But for the most part, to be honest, like I tell another story in the book about DJ Shortcut and some of the Scratch Pickles, who also worked with Vestex, a Japanese company. And you know, Shortcut in like 1993, he drew this design for a mixer. It was a real simple mixer, and he drew it on a napkin at a trade show, and he showed it to this rep for a company called Newmark, and they kind of like laughed at him because they were making these big monstrosity 19-inch mixers for mobile DJs. And eventually, you know, Shortcut connected with the people at Vestex, and you know, he brought along DJ Q-Bird and, you know, all the ISP to Invisible Scratch Pickles, and they started throwing ideas around with this company, you know, a couple years after the Trix mixer. And, you know, out of it, you know, in some R&D came the Vestex 05, which is sort of like the blueprint for all scratch mixers. And, you know, Shortcut, I talked to him at length about this, you know, he never got any credit for that mixer or for the design, never saw like any royalties. And it went on to sell hundreds of thousands, you know, and really changed that company's future and changed that company overall, just like the Rain 54, whether a lot of people would say it, I would say that changed that company's future. You know, and a lot of they didn't, you know, the guys who did the Rain 54 said there were some arguments when they were designing about credit and payment and should we get paid for this? And, you know, ultimately they decided no, and they'd rather just put it out. So how like these people get compensated, it could be with a free mixer or a few free mixers or support touring. For the DJs who had more of a brand name, they would be brought on as, you know, sort of brand ambassadors for the companies, like, you know, Shortcut was and Q-Bird were, you know, they were all kind of brought on in the face of Vestex. And so, but, you know, I tell in the book, you know, Vestex never paid them for that. It was sort of mutual marketing. So Vestex promoted the DJs and the DJs promoted the product. And that sort of authenticity of the DJs, you know, was placed on the product. But then you see them in ads and you see them on the product. And then it also authenticates the DJs. Most of the DJs I talked to who did like signature mixers or signature products, never, you know, never royalties. It was always free products, free support. I think DJ Craze, who did a Stanton signature mixer, he was like a 3-time world champion. He said he got a little bit of bread from having his name on a mixer, you know, but I mean, you know, compensation is definitely one of the main issues. And I think what most people wanted for compensation was credit, you know, like something in the manual or something, you know? And so that's ultimately for me, the whole vision behind this book in a lot of ways became like, how can I give some people credit? Now, granted, these are their stories, right? And everybody, it's really hard to say like, yeah, Shortcut's napkin on a drawing is that mixer, right? Because I actually have the drawing that Vestex came up of that mixer, and it's very, very different. But Vestex gave a lot of credit or gave credit for that mixer to its president, Toshi Nakama at the time. And they gave him credit for it and not Shortcut. But Shortcut also, like other DJs, like gave – a little idea here, maybe you should move this here, maybe you should do that there. And so how do you credit that network of creativity when people are like, you know, this, that? And so ultimately I found that with these products, like who's given credit is usually whoever branded the mixer. So an interesting example in the book, I write a little bit about this mixer called the Vestex 07. That was designed by this UK DJ, DJ Go. And he you know, claims to have designed it. And then like who the culture recognizes as the designer of it is, you know, DJ Q-Bird and Mixmaster Mike, because they were the faces in the advertising and marketing of the mixer. But here's this guy that nobody, you know, he's not a famous, super famous DJ, but he had a relationship with the company and he drew a design that became a very popular product, you know, and, but who's credited as the inventor or the innovator or the designer is the face that's attached to it, which wasn't, you know, wasn't the not popular dude. So at the end of the day though, you know, I think really people are just trying to get some sort of credit because it's about their legacy, you know, it's about their history, you know, and what they've contributed. I mean, every hip hop DJ, you know, I've talked to and know like that are out there, they want to make contributions. They want to be known for doing something dope and new and contributing in some way. And for some people, that's being an ill scratcher or manipulator or winning battles or whatever. And for others, you know, it's like having dope design ideas, you know, like, and like, how am I going to change the culture? It's through my design. So, you know, I wrote a lot about this DJ named DJ Focus, who invented, you know, literally, you know, came up with a contactless crossfader, changed the industry, changed the culture, you know, and his whole drive was like, I'm not going to make a contribution to this culture for scratching, but I'm innovative and I'm technologically savvy and I have ideas and, you know, and I have the drive to do them. And he did it. And he came out with one of the, you know, technologies that really changed the industry and the culture. And you know, that was his contribution. And he often has gone uncredited, for that, in a lot of ways and forgotten about. I mean, there's quite a few books and articles that I've seen that have been written about, you know, what we're talking about and what I researched that don't even mention his name when they're talking about like the crossfader or they're talking about like advancements in DJ technology. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, I know about this dude. Like, I've known about this dude and like, I know what he did, you know? And so I hounded Focus for years on MySpace. First on MySpace and then eventually on Facebook. And after about 5 years of talking to him, I got him to do some interviews with me for this book. And, you know, he kind of dropped off the face of the earth. And it was just, that was actually like one of the greatest moments in the whole book, was being able to tell his story, give him credit, put some shine on him, because no one had like given him any sort of light. And I thought his story is super important because it changed the industry and the culture, and no one was talking about it, but some heads knew, and he just wanted props, you know, he wanted to make his contribution in a different sort of way.
Well, this has been just fantastic. I have learned so much. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to the New Books in Music podcast. Today I've been talking with Andre Sirois, author of Hip Hop DJs and the Evolution of Technology, Cultural Exchange, Innovation, and Democratization. This is your host, Richard Schur. Thank you for listening.